Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. If you are studying for a vocation, particularly to serve those in the church or to serve in the church, to bring the good news of Jesus to people in your community or around the world, and you didn't have all the resources you needed to do that, who might you call on to help with those resources? Well, are we given as the church to help our brothers and sisters in Christ in our own neighborhood and beyond around the world? Are we given to share those gifts that God has bestowed on us with our brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world, that the good news of Jesus might be given in their community as well? We're going to talk about how we partner with our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world today to do that, and also take a look at how you can help neighbors right here in your own community, particularly children. What are ways that you can do that when a family is in need, perhaps needs some extra loving adults to help care for children in their families? We'll find out more about Bethany Christian Services and being a safe family for children. What does that mean in the second half? Joining us by phone this morning, the Reverend Anthony Oliphant, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Elmhurst, Illinois, to share about ways that he and others serve our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world, particularly in South Africa. Good morning, Pastor Oliphant.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us this morning and learning about your work with the St. Philip Mission Society and serving our brothers and sisters in Christ in South Africa. How did you get connected with this opportunity to serve?
Well, it actually began about 9 years ago when I was a student at the seminary in Fort Wayne, and there was a large group of students went, and we took the class, got to know the students in the seminary in South Africa, and when we got back, we were talking about the differences between the seminaries there, the resources we had, the opportunities we had, as opposed to the situations that they had there. And we were looking for a sustained way to help once we were back stateside. And so there was a group of us that after our ordination, we kind of put our heads together and decided to form the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society as a way to raise awareness of the seminary there here in the U.S. and also to raise funds for things like student aid. And pretty much through that continued association with the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society and the seminary in South Africa, that was how this opportunity came up for me to go and co-teach a two-week course down in Pretoria.
What were, as a seminary student, as a seminarian, what were some of the key resources that were helpful in your formation at seminary?
Well, it certainly was, the faculty was probably the main resource, just having dedicated men who knew what it was to serve in the parish, who are able to apply theology in a way that really kind of opens your eyes to see what it is that we believe and what it is that we should be teaching when we get out there. And that was one of the things that we had noticed that we really had in Fort Wayne was a strong faculty, that the students in Pretoria had a very limited faculty just due to resources. Their faculty there is outstanding, the people that teach there full time. They just don't have as many of them to go around or to teach as many classes.
So the resources that you had at seminary certainly were important, were helpful. When you visited the seminary in South Africa, what did you notice? You mentioned earlier you noticed that not all those resources were available or accessible to the students. How does that make a difference in their formation?
Right. It means that they had to be very creative with the way that they went about with formation. They had a very limited library, and so they had to find ways to share fewer books. They had limited resources with which to buy their own books. For many of them in their home countries, they don't have many Lutheran resources that have been translated. And so there's a lot of I mean, they essentially have to spend their first year there learning English, which is one of the official languages in South Africa, but the students from other countries in the continent. And so it was trying to find ways to work around the problems, the lack of resources that they had. And it really was very impressive to us, and that was what really drove us to help them find even more ways.
Help us understand what the Lutheran Church looks like in South Africa. I'm sure we have listeners around the world, but I'm sure many of our listeners are here in North America and probably a part of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. How does the church look in South Africa, particularly when it comes to Lutherans in South Africa?
Yeah, well, the Lutherans have very deep roots. There are actually two Lutheran church bodies in South Africa that we're in fellowship with in the Missouri Synod. And that was one of the really striking things that we found there, was that we have just a remarkable amount of similarity. The language that we use, the hymns that we sing, the liturgies, the chapel services that they have daily at the seminary are directly out of Lutheran service book. And so in many ways, it would look and sound the same. In other ways, I mean, obviously, you have multiple languages showing up in a service, depending on who's in the choir. You may have them singing in their own home languages. And so you really do see a lot of variety there, but in a lot of ways, in the ways that it really matters, we have a lot of similarity and continuity.
So you mentioned when you visit the services are very similar. You're right out of the same orders of service that we use here and hymns as well. However, as you mentioned, the languages might be different. Anything else that an American might notice or take note of when visiting when it comes to Lutherans, whether it's worship or other aspects of congregational life?
There is one thing that I did notice, and that is that the majority of the folks that come to the services there tend to be what we would call middle age or maybe younger. That there's not a tremendous amount of older folks there. That actually is one of the things that they wish they could have, is a little bit more of the older, wiser folks to give some more legitimacy in the eyes of some of the African cultures there. That's what it takes. But to see so many people of my own age there, which is very rare in the in American Christianity, as you know.
What did you go seeking to do on your most recent trip to South Africa?
My most recent trip was twofold. First, I was going and I was co-teaching a class with Professor John Pless from the seminary, and that was it was a 2-week course, and it was to help prepare future pastors all across the continent of Africa. And the second task that I had was to go as a representative of the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society and kind of be some boots on the ground, keep my eyes open for future projects that we could take on, and also to really get a thoroughgoing understanding of where we stand with a library project that we've been working on for the last 2 years.
And tell me about the students that you met and that you were there to teach with Professor Pless.
Okay. The students are, I was just continually amazed with them. They come from all over the continent of Africa, everywhere from Sudan, Congo, Tanzania. They have a number of them that are from South Africa too. They're from all over the continent. Many of them learned English to go to seminary. And so they're working in a language that is not their first language, and yet they have a remarkable level of talent in speaking and understanding English. And the level of insight in their questions really was just stunning. They were able to take some very deep theological concepts and apply them to potential future situations that they might have in the congregation. And so they're able to really take what we were learning about Lutheran teaching and already have a level of application that is, to be quite honest, I probably didn't have until my first or second year in the office. But to see them able to apply that theology already was very encouraging.
As you interacted with the students at the seminary, what did you learn about you or about the church at large? Did you see anything about were there any, I guess, perhaps eye-opening experiences as you interact with the students at the seminary?
Yes, yeah. The first is that there are a lot of concerns that we have with the church here in North America that is that's shared with our brothers and sisters in Africa. And that, I think, comes down to the fact that we all share a fallen human nature, and so we all have to address issues like sin. And then, of course, the antidote to sin, salvation. Also learning in all of the places where we do have those levels of similarity that there are certain issues that are unique to us here in North America that maybe aren't quite as much on their radar there. For instance, I taught a unit on addressing the new atheism, which is just running rampant in the United States. It was something that just wasn't even on their radar. It's not a major problem for them. But of course, defending the divinity of Christ is a major problem because of the opponents that they're encountering in the form of Islamic teaching. And so learning kind of the different cycles that church bodies throughout the world go through and the different questions that they're asking, that they may vary from time to time, but at the root always goes back to the basic fundamental teachings of the church at all time.
And tell me about the work of the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society this is Lutheran Theological Seminary, correct?
Yes, yeah.
So tell me about some of the work that that the Mission Society is doing, and particularly what you were working on while you were there.
Yeah, for the last 2 years, as I had mentioned a little bit earlier, we noticed that one of the resources that we had in Fort Wayne that was just outstanding is a library, which the library has since been expanded even since the time that we were students there. And it's just a remarkable, remarkable asset for the seminary there in Fort Wayne. And so we were looking at a way to possibly expand the library in South Africa. And so for the last 2 years, we've been raising funds. We've been partnering with the Rocky Mountain District of the LCMS. And we've been looking for ways to get a brick-and-mortar project off the ground. Up until that point, we had been focusing solely on raising money for student aid, which is still something we're doing. That was one of the things we were dedicated to do, was to not lower our support of student aid, but to pick up this library project in addition to what we had been doing. And so we successfully have raised about $15,000. The Rocky Mountain District has matched that, and we're looking at possible plans, future strategic planning for the seminary, and where exactly that an expanded library would fit into the seminary, both in terms of just space, but also in terms of how it will function as an asset for the seminary in the future.
How does the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society connect, the saints here with the saints in South Africa?
Yeah, it's mostly been kind of through what you might call grassroots efforts. Everyone on our board of directors and all of our officers are all parish pastors. And so we work in our home congregations to raise awareness. We've been invited to speak at mission festivals to inform people that aren't in our congregation about the good work that's going on there. We've also been invited to set up booths and present at at different fairs. For instance, I've been at Concordia Chicago. We had a booth for the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society there, and I had the opportunity to speak to a group of students over lunch. And so at this point, it's just kind of raising awareness of the fact that there's a lot of tremendous work going on at Lutheran Theological Seminary that's really benefiting the future of confessional Lutheranism throughout the entire continent of Africa.
How many students does this society serve today? How many students are served at the seminary presently? Is it Tshwane?
Yes, in Tshwane. Yes,
Tshwane.
There are 37 students there. There were going to be more that they had some trouble getting their visas to go to South Africa from their home countries, which it seems to be a perennial problem, just being able to get there for studies. But yeah, they had 37 students there. The class that I taught was primarily for seniors, for students who are in their last year or two of studies. We did have a couple of juniors come in as well, though, and several local area pastors that are already out serving the flocks around there, and so they come to these things as sort of a continuing education course.
Where do the students come from who come to the seminary? You mentioned some, you know, the numbers would be greater had some not encountered some of the difficulties of getting there because of, you know, from going from one country to another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they come from all over. There were several students from the Congo. There are about four or five students from Ethiopia. There's one student from Sudan. And so they come from all over the continent. And you can really see the ripple effect that seminary education there has as they take what they learn and they go back to their home countries.
Tell me about the faculty who serve there now. I know that you mentioned you and Professor Pless went as guests to teach. But tell me a little bit more about the seminary, the faculty, and the other programs, the programs that are offered at this seminary.
Yeah, well, the rector of the seminary is Dr. Wilhelm Weber, and he teaches a number of courses there in addition to running the day-to-day operations of the seminary, and he's our main contact point. While I was there, I also was able to meet Dr. Carl Bomer, and he is another instructor there. And then they also have a handful of professors that come in from throughout the world, and they kind of rotate in and out on a two-week cycle like we did. And so they, and as they're able to, they like to make use of the local University of Pretoria there as well. And so they will sometimes partner up with people from their religion or theology faculty there, and they will do some short-term projects together.
So these students and the faculty really come from a variety of places, including guest professors who are visiting and lecturing as well. And then the students go out from this seminary and serve not just in the local community, but many of them going back to their home countries, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah.
So having a seminary in this part of the world really is quite significant. What do you think the Lutheran Church would look like in South Africa without the seminary, without the resources that the seminary needs to provide formation for these future pastors?
Yeah, it's so hard to imagine it that I honestly can't picture what the Lutheran Church in South Africa would look like without the seminary. It has such an impact on the students that are from South Africa, of course, and then the students coming from all over. The fact that it serves as kind of a rallying point for continuing education and ongoing fellowship with the pastors that have already been ordained in the area, that it's really incalculable how important the seminary is to the church there in South Africa.
So with the work of pastors like you who go and serve as guest professors, guest lecturers, and some of our seminary professors really supporting that education, and then the work of St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society to provide more resources, such as a library. What's the outlook for this library at Lutheran Theological Seminary?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we had initially looked at just kind of expanding the space, trying to have more room. As it is right now, the building that they have just simply doesn't have enough room for the books. So they have books stored in various places throughout their campus. And we had initially looked at just kind of expanding a space. And then the more that I spoke to the faculty and staff there, the more it came out that what we really are looking to do is more than just storage for books. We're looking at also creating a center for solid Lutheran study and research, something that can serve as a rallying point for the entire continent, a place that has a facility that's also able to assist other Lutheran seminaries throughout Africa, either through internet connectivity or through sort of an interlibrary loaning process, something that would be able to serve the entire continent by being a real center for research and study.
Are there others besides students who are studying for pastoral formation? Are there others who are served by the seminary as well?
Yes, the seminary does have a daycare center, which is an amazing resource, an amazing asset for the neighborhood there. There are over 10,000 students or 10,000 children in the city of Pretoria that are just unable to get into early childhood education. And so to open up a daycare center, they've increased their size by tenfold in 3 years. And so there are a number of children that are served by the seminary's location there. There are also deaconess students who are training, and there are a few families that have come with the students who are given a nice, safe place to live while their husbands and fathers are studying to become pastors.
So there is a sense of, it sounds like there's a sense of community at the seminary.
Yes, a very strong sense. Yeah.
What role does it play? You mentioned having a daycare. How is the seminary regarded by the community there in Shawana?
It's strongly respected. The way that the education system there goes is every school is expected to matriculate into another school. And there's a local academy that holds the daycare center at the seminary in high enough regard that their students from the preschool are given priority to matriculate into the academy there, which is just down the street. The university will invite the faculty from the seminary to participate in a few local events. Actually, while I was there, the theology faculty invited the professors from the seminary to attend a anniversary celebration. I believe it was the 100th year anniversary of the theology faculty existing at the University of Pretoria. And so there is a lot of cooperation, and the seminary is held in quite high regard by other organizations in the area.
So the more that we can do to support the seminary so that it may continue to be a beacon and a place where the gospel is taught and men are equipped to be servants of the church, to be these servants of the word with this great education happening at Lutheran Theological Seminary, and as well as the diaconate and others who benefit from training at the seminary. This is an important thing, that important step that we need to take to continue to support this formation and education in at Lutheran Theological Seminary in Shawana. What can we do to help the St. Philip Mission Society do that work?
Well, first, you can take a look at the work that we have going on. We have a website, splms.org. There's also an option to donate through PayPal for those who are so moved to do that. And so We receive donations through PayPal, through checks. Any invitations, our board of directors is always open to looking at ways to come and speak to area congregations or mission festivals about the work that's going on there and ways that can be helped. And of course, obviously, the way that every Christian is given to help is through prayer for the students that are there, for the persecuted churches that they're sometimes coming from, and for the gospel to go out free and unhindered.
My guest today, the Reverend Anthony Oliphant, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Elmhurst, Illinois. Pastor Oliphant, thanks for sharing about the great work that the St. Philip Lutheran Mission Society is doing at Lutheran Theological Seminary in Shawana. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up in just a little bit, we'll learn more about Safe Families for Children. Also want to take a moment to say thanks to our friends at Concordia University, Wisconsin, the great work that they do in supporting Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. Check them out in the sponsor section, kfuo.org. More Faith and Family on the way right after this break.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
I want to tell you about a remarkable young woman named Karen Gaffney. She was part of a relay swim across the English Channel, and she swam over 9 miles across Lake Tahoe. These are amazing feats if accomplished by anyone. Karen happens to have Down syndrome. When she was born, the doctor told her parents she'd be lucky to tie her shoes or write her name. Karen loves to point out that he neglected to mention anything about the English Channel. Today is World Down Syndrome Awareness Day, when we celebrate the lives of those with an extra 21st chromosome. Visit our website, where we have tons of resources on Down syndrome, touching videos and documentaries, and Karen's amazing TED Talk on the subject. Visit lifeissues.org and click on the microphone icon.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson with an invitation for you to join me over the weekday noon hour for Moments of Assurance, your lunchtime spiritual recipe. You'll enjoy encouraging scriptures, a bit of Bible history and trivia, news items, humor, the kids' corner, and more, all mixed in with faith-strengthening sacred music, a blend just right for your midday hour. So join me, won't you? That's Moments of Assurance over the weekday noontime hour here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Imagine if I told you that an earthquake was going to hit tomorrow right where you live. That it would be 6.5 in magnitude with aftershocks occurring twice 25 minutes apart. You'd no doubt talk with your loved ones and you'd make a plan today. It's true, I can't tell you an earthquake will happen tomorrow. But what if it does? Shouldn't you have a plan? Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. For the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word. Because sarcoma is cancer. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is bringing hope to the families whose lives have been turned upside down by a cancer they had never heard of until diagnosis. Please join us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, go to curesarcoma.org.
This is Pastor John Veeker, Senior Assistant to President Harrison here in St. Louis. Agnus Dei Liturgical Arts continues the fine tradition of proclaiming the gospel through Christian art. Through the production of altarpieces, paintings, and drawings, Agnus Dei Liturgical Arts portrays the gospel in all its splendor. Their website is agnusdeiarts.com. That's agnusdeiarts.com.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. When families encounter difficult times, challenging times, particularly when moms face challenging times, circumstances that that call for the need, the help of others, what can they do? Sometimes they may feel like they're facing just unbelievable circumstances and not sure what to do. Are there organizations that help that can help them connect with another family to provide the support and care, particularly for children, that is needed during those times? Today in studio with us to answer that question, Madison Woody. She's a Safe Families for Children coordinator with Bethany Christian Services. Madison, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Glad to have you in studio this morning. I'm excited to learn more about Bethany Christian Services. I am somewhat familiar with the organization and the services that you offer, but I want to learn more and I want our listeners to learn more as well. Tell me a little bit about the organization, Bethany Christian Services, and the mission of the organization.
Yeah, so Bethany is an international organization. Our headquarters is in Michigan. Our mission statement is to demonstrate the love and compassion of Jesus Christ by protecting and enhancing the lives of children and families through quality social services. So here in St. Louis, we have adoption programs, we have international adoption, we have counseling, and we also have a program that I run called Safe Families for Children, which is what I'm going to talk about today.
Why is this your life's work? Why are you involved with Bethany Christian Services? I know you've served in other organizations, similar organizations in the past as well. Why is this something that, well, that you're involved in?
Yeah, I just, going through college and going through my career, I was called to social justice and social work because I want to provide support to families that really need it, families that don't have the safety net that I have had in my life. And I also, another aspect is I love seeing families and helping them be able to serve. As Christians, we have these hearts for service that we obviously need to have, that Jesus tells us to do, but sometimes we don't know how to get out there and do that. And so giving families that want to serve kids an opportunity to be educated and know how we do it in St. Louis and know what different cultures are like in our area and how they can serve kids in poverty and get out of their comfort zone. That's one of my favorite things about the work I do with Safe Families.
So providing a structure, an organized way to help families find ways to serve, particularly finding a unique way to serve if they have a desire to serve.
Yes.
So what is unique about the way that Bethany Christian Services serves families, particularly this Safe Families for Children program? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so what Safe Families for Children is, it's, I consider, a preventative foster care. So it's similar to foster care in the way that we have host families who are trained in background checks and they take kids into their homes on a temporary basis until a family is stable enough to get them back. But it's different from foster care because we're not removing these kids because there's child abuse or neglect or things going on like that. The moms are actually reaching out to us and saying, I don't have the support that I need. My kids have nowhere to stay. I've been evicted. I'm homeless. I don't know what to do. Can you help? And so these families are taking in these kids out of compassion. They're all volunteers, and they're just going to host them and support this family until the placing family can get back on their feet and provide again.
So this is a voluntary basis,
yes.
A service that's provided, that's requested on a voluntary basis.
Yes.
And so someone, a mom or a family, recognizes that they're not able to provide everything that their children need. They recognize that they need some help. They reach out and say, I need some help providing a safe home for my children. Can you help?
Absolutely. Yep.
And then, so then Bethany helps connect with a family that is equipped and desires to do that, to provide a safe and loving home for children who need it.
Yes.
How do you help families? How do you help families identify that, to be these safe families and equip them for that?
Yeah. So there is the process of becoming a host family. You have to be background checked. There's a required training. There's required references and applications. So it's, not as intensive as being a foster care family, but still we want to make sure we're having good people coming and taking these kids. Since it is voluntary, there is no no payment. It's just you get the support of our staff. When a child's placed in your home, I come out and visit once a week to make sure things are going well and provide support. We also highly encourage families that want to do this to have their own safety net, have their own family and friends who can provide meals and donations of clothes and things like that, so they're not feeling like they're doing this all on their own as well.
So families who feel like they have a strong network of support are really key for this.
Yes.
What's the response of families who have stepped up to be safe families for children? What's the response of those who've stepped up to serve in this way? What have they shared with you about their experience doing this?
They are some of my favorite people. One mom in particular, at a home visit I did a couple weeks ago, one thing that stuck out to me that she said is that she loves being the volunteer in this way because she knows that as Christians, we're called to serve and we're called to be messy. We're called to reach those who are broken and don't know Christ. And as a mom that stays home with her kids in the county, there's not much opportunity to be messy. You can't really like go to Africa with your family and all that stuff that we do of mission work. But doing Safe Families gives her the opportunity to serve kids who really, really need it and share the love of Christ to families who may have never heard that before, who are living in poverty. And she doesn't have to go anywhere. The kids come to her. Other families, they just having their eyes opened to out of their comfort zone and not in the bubble we sometimes live in as middle-class Christians, and being able to see poverty and other situations that we can share God's love with.
Tell me about the families who are served by this, and perhaps has Safe Families prevented some even worst case scenarios by providing that support to them?
Yes. So one of my go-to stories is a mom we worked with last year. She called us in October, and she had just moved to St. Louis about a month ago. She was living in a homeless shelter downtown, and she was fleeing domestic violence. And she had her two boys in tow. And while she was at the shelter, she had to find a job, but she had nowhere for the kids to go while she worked. So we were able to find host families for her. First, we were only going to do 2 weeks of hosting to get daycare set up, but that turned into 3 months. And eventually, she was able to find housing, get daycare, get a second job, and her boys were able to come back home to a safe and stable environment where if Safe Families wouldn't have been in her life, she might still be in domestic violence or be at the homeless shelter with nowhere for her kids to go.
What's the relationship between the host family and the mom or the parents who express a need? Is there any relationship between? Obviously, there's a direct relationship between the host family and the children. Is there any relationship between the host family and the mom or the family that's in need?
Absolutely, that is one of our main goals of Safe Families, to build those connections and build that support. The people that are going to connect the most are going to be the host mom and the biological mom. They're both caring for this child. Mm-hmm. And so they have that connection, and our goal is for them to not only be a service provider, but to become friends and stay connected even after the child goes home. So they can learn from each other. They talk on the phone almost every single day. Once a child's placed, we have you exchange phone numbers to send updates and things like that. And then we also encourage visits so they can see each other. So that's probably the biggest connection that's made. Part of my job is also to work with the families that use the program, the biological parents. And I see so often, no matter how hard I try, I can go and have lunch with these moms once a week and talk to them. I'm never going to build as strong a connection with them as the host mom does, because they have that middle ground that they're caring for the child.
For some, I imagine that to be a host mom or host parent, some might be a little intimidated by that. But at the same time, some might find that very Very intriguing that that they really want to connect with the biological mom. How has that worked out for the host moms in the past? What are some of the responses they've shared about building relationship with the biological mom?
Yeah, it can definitely be really intimidating. A lot of the moms that we serve are completely different than our host families. Our host families usually have support. They have they're middle class. They've had money all their lives. Most of our moms have been in generational poverty. So there is a big disconnect. You have to build that gap. But if our host moms are some of the most compassionate people that I know that are able to love these biological mamas unconditionally, and share God's love with them. And no matter how many times they may mess up or we may mess up, still being able to support each other and share that love is our biggest aspect.
Tell me about the education or the training for host families.
Yes, yeah, so there is required training, and that we have online or in person. Our next in-person training is actually coming this Thursday. We usually have about once a month. So that's the required training. That's what our national office tells us we have to do. We also have training that's not mandated but highly encouraged. There's a few books to read. There's a parenting class called Trust-Based Relational Intervention. It's an all-day class where we talk about how to parent kids that have come from trauma. And that's our highly, highly encouraged training. So the mandated training is pretty small, but then the encouraged training is much larger. And our families that go through those are ones that are our best servers and the ones I know I can depend on to care for these kids well.
Do you have host families that already have children in their home, whether they're their own children or other families, other children that have been welcomed in their home through a foster program or something similar to that?
Yes, the majority of our families have their own kids. I would say most of them, the kids are somewhere between the age of like 6 and middle school. We do have some empty nesters. We have some single moms who don't have their own kids. We have a couple that are foster parents as well. But it's, most of them have kids, but we do have a wide spectrum of families.
And what's the typical, is there a typical time frame that a host family might serve a child or a group of children?
Yes, yeah, so we have an abundance of hosting needs. For example, last year we were able to serve 164 kids in St. Louis, but I had to say no to 344. So right now we're only able to serve about 25% of the calls that we get. So there's always a need. We always need more host families. And so once you become a host family, I could have a kid in your house the next day if that was something you wanted to do. And length of time, it depends on the situation. It can be a couple weeks or it can be a couple months. And that is up to you. Host families are all volunteers. And so I'm not going to force anyone to take a child for longer than they feel comfortable to. And people usually let me know before they become a host family what ages and what time limits that they're okay with. Hmm.
So the training, is that an ongoing thing? Because you mentioned that you could become a host family within a day. So I gather that the training, the education is something that's ongoing.
Yes. So the required training is like a one-time thing. If you do it through our office, it's about 2.5 hours in person. And then we send you home with another PowerPoint to look at. But then training ongoing, a host family that's approved, I'm not going to give them a child that has a lot of chronic needs or has a lot of trauma background. They're going to get more of a short-term kind of trial run. And then as they do more training and get more involved, we'll look at the more extensive needs.
So it sounds like you work at connecting, matching up the needs of the children with the gifts, the strengths of the host family as well.
Yes, that's one of my the best parts of my job, that I know all of our host families very well. I consider them friends and I text them to give them updates. And so if I have a need that a mom calls, I know who I'm going to call to see, who can ask for that child. If no one comes to mind, I'll send that on email to our families and see who's available. But usually I'm pretty comfortable with who's going to take which kids.
What are the most common questions you get from potential host families, and how can we answer those today?
Common questions. They're always the scary ones. liability is one. Mm-hmm. Insurance, things like that. So our kids, most of them have Medicaid. And so they do have insurance, and host families are not required to pay medical expenses. Those are all, if the child is injured, the mom has to pay for those. There is no transfer of custody. There is no guardianship. We have a form called the power of attorney form, which the mom signs and gives the host family permission to care for the child. But if the host family has to give the child back early, there's no penalty for that. It's not a contract we can't change. And also a liability for our organization. So one of the things that we do at Bethany is if there were to be a major accident that happened, which I've been with Bethany for a little over a year now and nothing has ever happened for us to use this, but we do have insurance and coverage through Bethany. It protects our host families.
So I guess perhaps, you know, if something happens, a child gets sick or is in an accident and needs to go to a hospital, then the documentation that you have helps allow that, you know, the services to be provided.
Yes. So if a child has a scheduled doctor's appointment, we'll ask the biological parents to take them to that because we still want them to be involved and still want them to care for their kids. If they have, they fall down and they scrape their knee really bad, the host family can take them to urgent care and they'll just give me a call and let me know what they're doing. But they'll have the hosting agreement with the power of attorney that gives them permission to do that.
I see. So then the child's Medicaid and things like that would help provide for that child's needs. How do we become a host family? What are the steps you need to take, and how do we get there? You said we could do it in a day.
You can do training in a day, not the whole thing. But so the first step is to call our intake line. That phone number is 314-452-6547, and you can talk to probably me or one of our other staff members that has the phone to ask any questions you have. I can send emails about the program. The first step is to fill an application, and after the application is filled out, you can come to our information meetings or our trainings, and then the process of becoming a host family. After that, we do background checks and get 3 references and do a home assessment where I come out to your home to make sure it's safe. Typical things like your fire alarms work and there's no poisonous chemicals in reach of kids. And then once that's done, you're an approved host family.
Oh, man. I had some great questions, but I was really trying to listen to what you were sharing, too. I had another question. What about the connection between other, do other host families interact with host families at all? Is there any sort of community among them, I guess I should say?
Yeah, that's what we're really trying to build right now. There are a couple out in St. Charles County is where we see the most community. A lot of the host families out there, they know each other. They have a Facebook group that they post on and they say, hey guys, I'm getting a 4-year-old girl today. Does anyone have some 4T clothes I can borrow? Can someone send me meals for the week? And so we're trying to build more connection in the other counties that we serve. Recently, I sent out an email with all everyone's contact information to start building those. But it's highly encouraged that our host families know each other so they can support each other through this. Because our host families, they can ask me questions on how to handle situations. I can give them advice, obviously. But knowing that someone else has gone through this too, and knowing that someone else is doing this with you, is encouraging for them.
Are there, it sounds like a lot of the cases are younger children. Are there school-age children as well? And how do we work out school arrangements and things like that?
Yes, there are school-age kids. A good majority are under the age of 5. And that's for a couple reasons. A couple of things are most families don't want to serve kids older than their own children. So we see a lot of that. And also, if a mom has lots of kids, she usually has built-in babysitting. So we do see older kids. And so for school, there are 3 things that we can do for that. The first thing and the most wanted, but the least likely, are if the host family lives close enough to the child's school for them to just take them to and from school. The second thing is, if a child is considered homeless, there's a new law that's out called the McKinney-Vento Act, which requires the school to provide transportation for the child. So even if the child is all the way down in South County and their school is all the way up in North County near Illinois, the school is required to provide transportation if the child's homeless. If a child's not considered homeless and we still need to get them hosted, we may just transfer to the host family school if we know the hosting is going to be a little longer.
So the school arrangements can be worked out based on the situation.
Yes, absolutely.
Very good. And one other question before we wrap up here in just a couple of minutes. Thinking about, you know, the family circumstances, I would imagine that that privacy is important, especially for the biological family. How do you address those issues? What are some of the things you learn about that in the training, and how do host families handle that when they're, for example, introducing the children that are staying with them to other families?
Yeah. So most of the time, the host families and friends will know that they're a host family, and this isn't their child. A lot of times, privacy becomes an issue if the host family lives in the same area as the biological parent, because the biological parent may be embarrassed that they're using our services. It's hard to give your kids to someone else.
Or you mentioned earlier that in the case of domestic violence,
yes,
as
yes.
well, they may be escaping that.
Yes. So if you, like, someone were to approach you in public and say, oh, who's this kid that you have? We ask your host and they say, oh, it's just my friend's kid, and not explain to, like, random strangers what they're doing. But they can, obviously, the family and friends. We do have them sign a confidentiality agreement that even with their family and friends, they're not going to share the mom's whole life story with them, because our host families, they will know a lot of private information. We do ask a lot of questions to know what the situation is, what the mom's doing, what the kids are like, and we don't want them just telling the whole world. So they do sign a privacy agreement with that.
And so that I would assume includes things like, you know, social media and things like that. We're not going to be posting
Correct.
Pictures of children on social media.
Correct. A lot of our host families will post pictures, but put a little, like, sticker smiley face over the kid's face to maintain that confidentiality.
Sure. Confidentiality is, I'm sure, key in those circumstances. You mentioned Bethany is an organization headquartered in Michigan. Are there other cities and states that have the Safe Families program?
Yes, it's actually all across the country right now. I'm not sure exactly which states, but a good majority of them have Safe Families. And also, it started in Europe and a country in Africa, I think South Africa. And I think it's going in Canada right now, too. So it's a pretty well-known organization. Safe Families for Children is actually a separate organization from Bethany, and that's based in Chicago. Bethany just runs the program in our location.
In the St. Louis area. Well, very good. So we can find out more about Safe Families for Children around the country, well, around the world, really. I'm sure just a quick search on Google, find more information about that and how you can become a Safe Family. It has been a pleasure learning about Bethany Christian Services and Safe Families for Children here in St. Louis with our guest, Madison Witte, coordinator for Safe Families for Children. Thanks so much for being my guest today, Madison.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word on listener-supported worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.